This is a production of Cornell University.
Student Assemblies meeting November 20th, 2008.
Recorded.
Is it recording?
Is it recording, dude?
Hi, everyone. Calling the student assembly meeting to order, November 20th, 2008. It is 4:45 p.m. Will the clerk please call the roll? While we're getting the roster over, we have a very full packed meeting today, and an extended one on that note, so we're going to be as efficient as possible. So everyone just keep that in mind. Okay.
Here.
Baker.
Here.
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 Craig.
He'll be late. Next, we have approval of the minutes from November 6, 2008. Ace is here. Are there any motions?
Call for affirmation.
Is there a second? Any dissent? All right, minutes have been approved. Open microphone. Anyone in the audience who would like to bring something to the SA's attention that is not currently on the agenda, please feel free to do so now. Looks like we're all set. All right, moving right on to announcements and reports. We have a Residential Life Committee update by Representative Kumar.
So we had a meeting this past week, 2016 minutes, followed up on our discussion the week before about the housing market. On the meeting minutes, I came down to the Department of Community Life tomorrow to talk about revamping the housing ladder brochure, as well as using the SA meeting communication to possibly get out of this meeting more about the issues about the housing ladder. We came up with some of the projects that our committee can start working on regarding sustainability, and we will be working with our team and other campus organizations to start working on some of those projects. We're grabbing some of the information again and today about the sustainability project. So I'll be able to update you more fully in the future.
Excellent. Any questions for Nikhil? I have a question. You talked about the lottery. Are they looking at changing anything specific to the whole lottery system?
Basically, they'll change in terms of policy with the one I mentioned last week. So I'll be bringing up some bits of concerns at the end. But my inclination is that it's more of a policy thing. So if we want to express it, we can actually put that in.
Okay. More questions? All right, great, thank you. We have an employee assembly update by Representative Cusick.
So yesterday was my first employee assembly meeting, and we discussed mostly the economic crisis and a possible forum for staff and faculty to voice their concerns to high-level administration. That's still in the works, maybe in like a brown bag lunch format. And also we have the Vice President for Human Resources, Mary Opperman, come to the meeting, and she discussed the hiring freeze, job loss, and ways to streamline procedures so we can cut costs around the university. And we also discussed the results of a staff climate survey, which has been mostly positive.
Great, excellent. Any questions for Emily? Nope, moving on. We have an Iowa faculty evaluations announcement by Representative Stein.
So this past Friday, I met with the ILR faculty at their semi-semesterly meeting, and we discussed course evaluation. Currently, the faculty is very split, and I know that this was an issue of interest to a lot of you, not just because it's within ILR, but because it's something going out throughout the Cornell community. And one of the problems that they're really addressing are problems with the actual evaluation form, as opposed to problems with publishing, which is kind of where the whole discussion ended up headed. So I would like help from anyone who's interested in this topic, either in ILR or throughout the university, on putting together some questions that students would like to see published, as opposed to questions that the faculty would like to see published. And that's something that we'll be working on. I've gotten a seat on the committee that's addressing that issue, so please come to me or email me if you're interested in helping out.
Excellent. Any questions for Rebecca? All right, great. We have an academic integrity update by DP Basil.
All right, I met with Dean Wolcott, who is still spearheading the academic integrity initiative on Tuesday. And basically what he wants to do is he wants to move things forward productively going forward. And it turns out that the committee on the Faculty Senate that's in charge of this sort of thing is called the APC, the Academic Planning Committee, or something like that. But basically what he recommended that we do is we convene the Academic Integrity Drafting Committee, which we all passed at the beginning of the semester, to draft some sort of temporary framework document, have the Assembly sort of endorse it, and then bring it to that Faculty Senate Committee, because it's that Faculty Senate Committee that actually has authority over these kinds of rules. So I will be convening that committee, I guess, hopefully just sort of with a very brief meeting in the next couple of weeks, and then more seriously after break probably. But yes, I guess just I'll send out an email for people to be involved in that, so get ready for that.
Any questions for Chris? No questions. Any further announcements?
So you get the report, so they had their meeting last Monday, they discussed, they approved their new budget, which has a lot of money to approve, besides that, they're looking to do things like guidance on it. Also, they passed a few resolutions dealing with housing, and they're looking to create a resolution for the media.
Question. Have you addressed the scope issues at all? Or have they been discussed?
In their new budget, they have not outlined any funding for slope day. They turned last year's $1.50 per student budget, like funding last year, they called it a gift. So far this year they haven't they have to address the issue, but next meeting, they're meeting with the programming board, so the programming board, and so they'll be rushing the issue in the upcoming time.
No, I'm not actually. I asked Chris, if, as our liaison at Slope Day, I don't know if you had any updates in regards to that.
The Slope Day is presenting their data, if you could say, next week, I think.
December.
Okay. Basically, they, I think my attitude, at least from the Slope Day Executive Board attitude, is we'll sort of wait and see how it's received. We'll go from there.
I think a goal of the Slope Day Programming Board and also the Student Assembly is that the next Byron funding cycle, which is next year when everyone proposes the budgets, will reflect all those statistics.
Yeah.
I know different undergraduates have, want different things to happen, but I think first and foremost, at least, I know Slope Day and members of the SI who have been working with them want everyone to match the statistics in a way that's cooperative first. But if anyone has any issues with that or wants to be more involved with those discussions, I would say contact Chris and we'll see that that happens. Any questions? Additional reports? ASAP.
Yeah, I have a two-part thing. First of all, UA met yesterday. Something that was discussed, we had information from CPIC, from transportation development, also campus planning, I think it was battle, the safety of the individuals who are attacking them, what sort of development cases are going through. So that was a very interesting presentation. Something that came up at the end of the the presentation, which I brought up, which I think is very pertinent for all of the students, you know, given the light of the financial struggles and the markets and so forth, what are priorities being placed on in terms of administration to stabilize our Cornell community of any student in study. And so I think given that there was a financial aid announcement that we put out last week or a week and a half ago, that's something that I think that we can look into. Some of the members of the UA just want more information as well. If you're interested in that, you can contact either the Snyder Act, and maybe we'll look into that in the future to see how we're going along the line. Additionally, I just got out of a communication task force meeting, and it was interesting. The task force is comprised of cities, state officials, as well as administration officials. So we have some more clear goals of where we're going. For us as our ad hoc committee, definitely again, we're moving forward. We have more outlined education initiatives that we need to really start getting moving on. So if you're interested, I know a couple of people that I've been working with, but if other people are involved, it's really going to start kicking off in the next couple of weeks and probably a little bit over break as well. And start working with that YouTube office as well as orientation committee. So if you're interested, let me know. That's when we start.
Great. Any questions? Question.
Yeah. Is International Women's Day also discussed in the meeting?
It was discussed in the whole initially the students as well as a whole. That's something that we also need to look at as well.
Because it's different, obviously, different.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't necessarily, talking about what is the structure of financial aid. I was making sure that, one of the plans that we proposed was having I think $10 million to mark roads around the county so that bikers were more sustainable, things of that nature for our campus as we move forward. But I'm saying, if you look at that $10 million, $520,000 scholarship to be awarded to students. So I would really say, as we're looking at these different sort of initiatives, while it's great to build these bike things and work on these roads, the main importance of students coming here is to get an education. So how it's broken down, that's something that we can also discuss with the financial aid committee, but I think it's important to remember that, while we move forward with this development goal and the most time hall, to remember about all the students here that need to be time.
Yeah, and is Rem here? Rem's on. I know him, Rem is chair of JFARM because we've seen with Gretchen Ryan, who's one of the directors over at Financial Aid. We can expect when President Scorton comes that he'll touch upon the new financial aid policies and we can ask questions. But also, he has brought up international financial aid issues along with others. And I know they've been talking, so hopefully, in the next meeting, we'll have some sort of update for that. Any other questions? All right, additional announcements or reports? Emily.
First, let's say thank you for everyone that came last Saturday. Tony, you did a good time.
I had a blast.
Did you have to get a raffle yet or not? Okay, perfect. So we actually did a winner, we saw it. And we have so many ideas. We've been typing up all week. We still haven't finished. And we're finalizing our matrix. So in the next few months or so, we'll actually have calls away. And if you have interested, I'll tell you what made and what you did. So thank you again.
Yeah, great. And that one, thank you. I heard that one really well. We appreciate all your efforts. Any questions for Emily? Great. Any additional announcements or reports?
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
Sorry, I left them. Okay. So the conference committee is going to meet tomorrow at 5 o'clock in Tower Cafe of Harris Library, and we're going to put together our big end of semester bulletin, which I know I asked many of you to contribute to, and I don't know why I didn't do this earlier, but if any of you want to submit anything at all, please feel free to do so. It's definitely not too late. We're going to be working on that over the weekend and hoping to have everything done by Monday. Because of Thanksgiving, what I'm going to do to make sure everyone can approve it is send it out via the listserv, and then just you'll send us, me and Vince, that feedback. We can make all the corrections. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes, so with the bulletin done, is that going to be approved by the committee, or is it approved by the OSA or after that?
At this point, it's been a committee making the final touches, but I want everyone's feedback a lot. So if you could all read it when I send it out and then send that to me, that'd be great.
And on that, in the note of wrapping up the semester, I will be asking all committee chairs or really anyone who's been doing anything, so that's all of you. When I submit my end of the term report to the president, I'll include, you know, people's summaries, people's initiatives, all that. So I'll be emailing you individually, but just you know, look out for it.
Did you resend that you can use the same summaries that we send in?
Yeah, if they're applicable, sure.
Yeah, I'm just, okay.
Any questions? All right. No further announcements or reports? Great. Moving on to business of the day. First up, we have SAFC handbook changes. Representative Smith, Taylor Mulheron, and Varun. Varun's not here. I am left.
Why? Yeah.
They're representing.
They're moving forward today?
Yeah.
We're not, except election changes.
Let me clarify. SAFC handbook changes are business of the day. You don't need them, we didn't need them to be on new business because they're not charter changes. Election rules is actually on new. It's actually new business.
I just put everything there. Just note.
Okay. So are you going to go by resolution first? Is that it? However you want. Yeah, 5 minutes.
Okay.
That's up to you, whatever you think is more efficient, but
yeah. Okay, you guys can understand. So up top here is just sort of some explanation about things. The breadth of the year, therefore, is all that in the sense of embody that. So that's kind of that explanation. Right? And then down a little bit further in that paragraph, we've changed President Treasurer's handbook to the Student Assembly Finance Commission funding guidelines. That's just what we call it now. So we forgot to change that.
Yep. After the review further resolved that, those are all basically programmatic changes. There's really nothing policy-wise to change there. The meat of it is in the first few therefore as well. So just the four changes basically. For appeals, we are now making it mandatory that all groups go to an appeal hearing. So the way it currently is, you can appeal to the FAC. And you just look over your budget again, you don't have to come to a hearing. So if you want the purpose of communication, us missing anything, then you have to explain something. You have to come to a hearing. So the charitable fundraising events, right now, we can't even fund for an event whose purpose is to raise money, whether or not the money from SAFC goes to charity or not. So the way we want to change it is the money still does not go to charity. But if you're going to say, comic concert, where participants donate to charity, we said that's probably fine, as long as the money we're giving them doesn't go to charity as well. So we're still basically just funding an event. Airfare, we have some groups that get airline tickets before they apply. So they get maybe a $400 airline ticket, but if we fund by mileage, we have to allocate them sometimes $3,000. So this basically just says, if you already have airline travel, we'll fund to the lower of the two. So, and finally, yeah, the rest is pretty radical. So totally main changes. We can go through if you want.
Yeah, go through them quickly.
All right, I'll finish then. Next thing is we change gearing to the budget hearing. Next to it. We struck out with the cost out there and then added the bullet. So that should be easy enough to see. The next paragraph, or this section here, includes some information about what I talked about with charity. Now it was raising funds for profit, so the charity can have. And then we added in the bullet part, raising funds for charity, and I'll see that as another easily substantive. Service related to the mission of the organization. So Brian said, as long as it has some other focus other than just money away, we're okay with that.
process of plan, include the airfare costs, the bottom page there. And then on the next page, the last page, we say either the lesser of either the IRS rate or the actual documented airfare costs. So there's 2,000 miles to get some sort of amount of money with plane ticket $300, we just want to do that. And then the level. Oh, we had an exact number of people traveling. It just used the same numbers, and there was a little confusion about that.
Like an advisor letter. So we got a lot of advisor letters that would say, we need 30 or 40 people. But we just changed to say, specify that we need the exact number of people traveling. So that's a bit of a change for anyone. And then the last thing, we crossed that will be funded just for grammatical.
Okay. Great. Thank you for us now open. Let me just clarify. In the past, we haven't been in a resolution format like this. However, you're a little confused, Vincent. But I think it was decided that this is just be better. It's more formal. That's why they're submitting it like this. Normally, it's just they present the handbook changes and we have to approve them by majority. Still need a majority. It's just now resolution format, so we'll have the clerk hold the roll and everything. So, speaker's list is open. Tony.
I'm going to call the question.
Second.
I'm going to call the question. There's a second. Is there any dissent? All right. Clerk, please call the roll. All right.
Yes.
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 Yes. Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Sorry. Excellent. Resolution 17 passes. Which resolution would you like to have? Would you like to do? Resolution 16. 3 minutes. Okay, so on the back of that page, the last be it further resolved clause, number 6, appeals, the sentence that starts with after the SFC has made decisions about all submitted appeals, etc., to the end there, all that.
Can I just make a point of information?
Yeah.
Those are actually included in the funding guidelines now. There's the appeal procedure that goes through the SA.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure why it would need to be stated here as well.
Okay.
In the funding guidelines, it tells organizations explicitly what their rights and responsibilities are for.
And these are the bylaws of the SAFC? With the SAFC.
Yes, which is a much shorter document.
Okay. Which is part of their charter. That's not Group C, essentially?
Right.
Okay. Well, that's up to you guys.
Okay. And never mind. Oh, for me.
Okay. And it is in the guidelines?
Yes.
In all of our, okay. And it will remain stricken.
Okay. So, basically, appeals on the basis of new information, we're getting they're basically under one category now that you can appeal. So we're getting rid of new information because is better described as until the basis of circumstances has changed, and they don't differ from special project requests, accepting the priority funding. The opportunity to change circumstances, which occur later in the transfer should not be disadvantaged here because this occurs during the information appeal period. Organizations should be able to appeal mistakes made by the commission, say mistakes made with respect to special projects and requests throughout the semester, and should not only write after regular applications are released. Applicants may submit an appeal of a decision on the grounds that the commission erred either in its application of rules or in finding success. The appeal must be submitted within the same academic semester as the student action type specific action. Errors that is the dispute and some appropriate documentation and there's for the remedy that the applicant can be resolved with commission in July. So we further resolved bylaw 6 and 7
Alright, just before I open up the speakers list, so essentially you're eliminating the categories for appeals. Am I getting that? Am I correct in saying that?
Yeah.
What?
So there will now only be one category, which is FACR.
Okay, so essentially there are really no categories anymore. You're just appealing.
Yeah.
Alright, speakers list is open. VP Mezzi?
I think they're all good, except for 6. I think it should state the deadline for appeals will be determined each semester, blah, 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 up until the point where it says prior, and then strike that last one. So I'd like to motion to unstrike the section from the deadline to the essay. I don't know how you want me to say it formally.
Yeah, Mary said it. Do you guys find that friendly?
I agree with it.
You all find it friendly? Okay, then it's there. So just to... Can you just repeat that?
Maybe. Yeah, basically, we read the SAFC will set aside, blah, 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 appeal their allocations. The deadline for appeals will be determined each semester, but is generally within a week of the allocations being made available. After the SAFC has made its decisions about all submitted appeals, organizations will have the opportunity to appeal directly to the SA. The SA VP of Finance should be contacted for such appeals to the SA, period.
Okay, period. And that's where you want to, okay. And the rest is stricken, right?
Correct.
Okay, and you found that friendly. That's how it is. Moving on, that's how it stands. Representative Craig.
So I guess just going back to the past 2 months of the that you've been doing with appeals. So now that students cannot appeal on the basis of new information, how does that only clause that was put into it take effect? They submitted something, they found out 5 days after the deadline.
So in years past or semester past, there is a distinction between special projects and this new information. Special project is something that was unforeseen and not included in the original budget. And so we had drawn the distinction between something that was kind of mildly related to related to the original budget, so say the soccer team is going to nationals, and so that's new information. That's a special project. And then something like you need a bigger room for an event that you already requested, that's new information, something like that. And so we decided that it's not necessarily fair to give preference to the bigger room over the nationals because it's essentially. That
30 seconds.
For example, we and I did a special project this semester because we didn't have enough money. So now special projects and new information are treated as the same thing. So what you mentioned about soccer.
for the state soccer team. We're not going to fund you for your playoff trip. We don't know if you're going to be in the playoffs. If you get into the playoffs, you apply for special projects. Say, hey, we got into the playoffs, we need more money.
So does this mean then that the number of groups and affiliations significantly cut down because they can only apply on the strict error? Or
it'll decrease the numbers of appeals, but it'll probably increase the numbers of special projects just because we want to make more special projects.
And the special projects will never come back to SA to decide what is deemed a special project?
Okay. They could still come back to the SA if you applied for a special project for your group and it wasn't approved and you were unhappy with it. You felt the SASC made an error in reviewing a special project, you could appeal back to the SA.
Can groups receive that notice if they have those information available?
Next on the first speaker list, Representative Dyko.
I have two questions. One, so the money that you're setting aside has, and you just like reworded it, and number seven, that still has a rollover effect?
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. And also, I'm a bit confused about the appeals now. So it's like the Jeff was in me, so does that make me feel any kind of about the semester? For the initial
funding,
or that's
still
only for
special projects? With Greg, reverse draft. What do you mean, sir?
I don't remember.
Is that on the field fees term each semester? We're starting with on week allocation.
Yeah.
That means each semester we create a deadline.
Okay,
so it will be a hard deadline. It's just, it could move around each semester.
Anyone on the first speaker's list? No, I'll move on to the second. All right, second speaker, Ben.
Number seven. The bold part says the SAFC may set aside a portion of its funds prior to regular allocation. I think it should say will set aside funds, just because may, I think, is kind of up, like, they may set aside funds, they may not. So I think if they say will set aside a portion of its funds prior to regular allocation, it's just a little bit more definitive. And I think it puts them in a position to have to set aside a portion.
Do you find that friendly?
Yeah.
Okay. VP Miller.
How much money or percentage are you thinking is going to go into the special request fund?
I mean, it's more, you know, a guesstimate usually. And in the past, since we've always kind of run that money the last two semesters, we have kind of limited how much we can put aside. It's been about $60,000 per appeal. That's always been a general rule. So whenever we make big changes like this, it's kind of back to guessing.
Yeah.
Until we have better ideas. So, I mean, we'll probably take some of that $60,000 in appeals to put into such a project, which usually has been between $10,000 and $20,000, something like that. So, you know, altogether we probably between appeals and special projects probably about $80,000.
And you think that'll kind of offset where people usually get their allocations for trips or projects that come along, and it's just so in reality it's not gonna give any more or less money, it's gonna make it easier on the commission and easier for groups to do it on kind of a rolling basis. Not really rolling, but like as events come up, they'll be able to do it. Makes it easier for both commissioners and the groups. Is that the purpose?
Yeah.
Okay.
Next on the speaker's list, BC Basil. Call a question.
I second that.
Second, is there any dissent? All right, let's just call the roll.
Motion to hand vote.
The motion to hand vote. Is there any dissent to hand vote? All right, we'll hand vote. All in favor of approving resolution 16, please raise your hand. All opposed? Any abstentions? At 20-0. Okay, great. Resolution 16 passes. Resolution 15. Resolution 15, 3 minutes.
Sure. Okay, so this one deals with the project rule that's put in place this semester. We are, you know, putting forward that we actually submitted it. It was nearly impossible to believe, some numbers. We gave out $42,490 rule loan, and then total we gave out just over $550,000, so that's a pretty significant amount of money. We, and I can just kind of run through we couldn't prepare and review all the materials submitted after the deadline because they're kind of flying in at us. We have about, I think, 50 budgets that we had to go through a third time after appeals. It was just difficult for the office. There's only two people in there to go through all this. There was no firm date set with this rule, so it was kind of done as an afterthought. So, you know, technically, a group is open in today, 3 months after we all budget stuff, and still the project is 25%. And along with the elections, kind of beat first of the deadline anyway. So when we can allow they think they come in, there's really no point in having any deadline. Very difficult plan for that task to keep the group together correctly because we have to kind of set aside an arbitrary amount of time in the event that the group come in and request a 25% cut. And so, really, everything is written out in that rule other than the commission will not accept it. So, it's pretty cut and dry. Just want to get rid of it.
Thank you. Speaker's list is open. VP Mezzi.
I think this definitely is a good move. It did cause a lot of problems, and I think while the spirit of the rule was well intended, it in practice it really didn't make sense. And I think one of the things that the SAFC and SA are trying to do in working together and reexamining the policies is try to come up with a better way to do it. But I think leaving something like this in here will just cause kind of more detriment in the future. And I think it's our job to look at better ways to improve, but think of ways that we are well thought out. So I definitely 100% support this action.
Representative Stein.
I'll call the question.
We'll call the question. Is there a second? There's dissent. I'm going to keep moving on the speaker's list. DP Miller.
So I'm curious. I know the SAT at the end of the semester, or like a week ago, you guys really did take a look at it and try to find out the best solution. Did you guys consider like any sort of middle ground? You know, obviously the 20% would cause a lot of problems for everybody involved. Were there any other solutions tossed around by you guys that might have been productive, FASC?
Well, I mean,
this Friday
meeting is what we've been having. Their primary purpose is to solve an issue like this. So when we met with our commission, we just basically went on the handbook changes and decided that this rule should be better left to that kind of committee of business every week to discuss this type of thing. Because it was ultimately a policy that came from the SA in the first place, so we thought that it would be better to work with you guys on that. And just add, I agree with them in spirit. I think if it's successful, it takes a nice that they have some chance. But the SA is not ready to implement it yet, so this is actually hurting groups. It causes a lot of confusion. That's one of the biggest problems when groups try to get money from the FSC, they're just confused about how it works. This doesn't help. So I think when we sort everything out in the next couple of semesters, this is something that can be revisited, but right now it's not people.
The only reason is I know I'm part of the Friday, I go to all the Friday morning meetings. I know we're close to getting something, but I know it's just going to be a little bit longer until we finally get something cemented, so hopefully we'll be getting it. I support this because I've been very involved in the own appropriations committee as well, and for those of you guys only in public who haven't had a chance to come to FASC meetings or these appeal meetings, it gets very confusing, as Taylor said. It worse than it has to. Of course, I work in the office more than pretty much anyone at the table, and I can tell you I've seen Karen almost pulling her hair out on a daily basis. When they try to deal with it, it was a good idea. There's always the appeals process. I guess it's going to put the burden on us things for another semester, but that's our job anyway. So I do support this, and I'm sorry it didn't work out.
Next is Representative Cusick. I had one question. Theoretically, if a group budget doesn't pass because they have a mistake, can they apply for special projects later on?
Since I've been a pusher, we've never had anyone who has done special projects. I've never really done
it. Right. I only ask, with this new change.
With it? Sorry. If we got rid of this?
No. With the new change with the special projects, I mean, doesn't it also provide
mean, special projects is really designed for stuff you couldn't have applied for. Because if you started doing things like that, then that would probably be a whole new mess of issues. But I think like a soccer example is a perfect example of why we need special projects. New information, I think that's one of those.
Okay. Representative Cusick.
I yield my thank you.
Representative Andrews.
Can you quickly repeat the numbers?
Yeah, we give out $42,490.07 with a 25% reduction. In total this semester, we give out $568,480.50. So 7.61% of our total allocation went to 25%. And that's actually money we pulled from the spring.
So, I mean, the reason why I was just asking for the numbers is because I feel like a lot of groups are benefiting from this rule in a good way. Groups come to the FAFC and they look to create projects that benefit the student body. And I think that the purpose, again, of the FAFC is to fund these groups. To, you know, the FAC is extremely rational and they allocate money fairly, and I truly believe in the sense of the body, and I think they're doing a great job at it. But I think that late registration, or, you know, if you don't get your application in time, or if you make an error, for example, I know that in the past, the student assembly was extremely strict on, you know, if you have a period, they call that an error and you're done. You know, your application is automatically rejected. So I don't think that we should throw out this rule completely. Maybe it should be amended. So therefore, I would like to amend the motion.
So you're just motioning to amend.
Yeah, motion to amend. Excuse me. To unstrike the second paragraph that's been stricken from the back page.
From the back page. Which paragraph?
The second one there that's been stricken.
Okay. That's your motion?
Second.
Yeah.
Is there any dissent? Dissent. Let me just read that paragraph. If an error is recognized after an application has been submitted, an organization can still receive funding for that error, but must provide documentation that the error or errors could have been readily corrected prior to the application deadline.
So
an organization will receive a 25% reduction in the stipulated areas where the error occurred in the application. Do the sponsors find that friendly?
No.
Okay. Yep.
Just continue going. So again, now if you notice that I actually haven't taken out, you know, if you submit it late, okay, leave that strict, if you submit it late, you don't get money. But just to keep this, you know, well-meaning, if you want to call it, proposition within bylines, I think that, you know, that last paragraph is necessary, and I don't think that it'll be keeping it too much.
Okay, because there was dissent, and I now have a speaker's list to discuss the amendment. So for anyone, first on that is Representative Craig, then you are. Yep.
So I was going to speak actually for the amendment, and I think that you brought up a good point. There's a difference between not getting it in and coming up with an error. I think if you look at some of the resolutions that come to us, I mean, we have errors in it, and things need to be corrected. There's things of that nature. I think this is a good idea. It allows students to necessarily, they may not be able to get special projects. I mean, we asked about what they apply for special projects. It's a little bit up in the air to see what is responsible. I do think this is a good idea. I feel though that to satisfy both sides is something that we can do. We have a deadline where something needs to be in. I say a lot of teachers, you know, organization a week to go over and prove what they're going to do, proofread it so that they can see if they made an error. By the end of that week, if there is no error, you know, found, then perhaps they should, you know, then we can go into discussions about not receiving their funding. This allows them that 3 months from now, people can't say, you know, I made an error, now I'm giving my 25%. I feel though this helps to give some responsibility to the group. This also makes them necessarily look at the rules. We're talking about, you know, a lot of things that we say when they come up for appeals. So
30 seconds.
We didn't look political rules, you didn't care about the rules. Just, you know, make them say, you've got to meet political rules, you've got to meet with the organization to take into effect and to really look at what you say. That way they can have that change. So,
30 seconds.
So, what I'm going to do.
Another
thing. I'm going to work on coming up with where I can stipulate weeks in this so that it makes sense proper English wise. So,
English
wise. The other time, maybe about a minute.
Okay. I am going to respond to that. I'm going to give Lavin.
I mean, I just heard him correctly. We want to give like a week before the rules and what this is. Why wouldn't they just do that before?
Oh, no, we're going to move on the speakers list. You heard what I said. Ari.
Yeah, I received a lot of feedback on this rule from both the staff beyond that works with SAFC and commissioners, and even some feedback from organizations, mostly that have been upset that this rule hasn't been applied liberally enough. And this was viewed by our staff and by the commission as something that really must change. And some of the things I want to point out to be very clear is organizations have at least 2 weeks between the start of the semester when applications become available and when they're due to review the rules. There are several help sessions where they can meet with the commissioners and get help understanding things. They can come into the office to get help preparing their application. The whole point of this deadline is that there's a very small amount of time after the deadline for our office to compile all the material, the SAFC to review those materials, and there's just no practical way to implement this. What happened this semester with the SAFC has made a lot of arbitrary calls, including like calls about, you know, when are we going to accept errors on table, because this doesn't say anything about that.
1 minute.
And furthermore, I think that Resolution 16 is a partial response to this. One of the biggest issues for a lot of groups is they might have events that they want to get funding for, and they know they won't be able to get special project funding for, so they rush material together at the beginning of the semester. By allowing the SAFC to set aside money exclusively for events that come up later in the semester, I think you're addressing the more legitimate basis on which organizations would use this rule.
30 seconds.
And just to give you like a comparison of other processes, it's a registration deadline, but it's okay if you register a week later or if a bill was due, but it's okay if you do it later, it guarantees that some significant number of people will turn it in later and we just can't process that.
VT Mezzi.
I just wanted to say about the week thing that Asa mentioned. They have the whole period while they're preparing their budget to review it. Then the other thing that I would also like to mention is you mentioned something, Vince, about pulling, or about it's a good thing and we're providing things. We pulled $44,000 from the spring allocation. So we're now $44,000 less in the spring to provide to groups because of this 25% error rule. So while it is, yes, it's good for the students now, in the spring, we're going to be down $44,000. If we...
Yes.
New special projects thing that's going to be expected to be pulled away from the spring or from the fall.
SFC? Well, that would be for the next semester, I would assume.
So we're still taking away money. It's just going to be...
No,
you don't.
We're in spring, theoretically. It would be from the spring budget. I'm assuming SFC.
Yeah, so say we have $500,000 for the spring. We had to take $40,000 to use in the fall. So we have $460,000 left. And that will take the week for special products in the field. So it would be $308,000 to give to the
school. So it wouldn't be taken from any other semester. It would be in that budget. They set that aside in the beginning of the year.
I guess my point of information then is, so if we're enlarging the special project, we're still going to be enlarging the money that we take away, right?
Not from another semester. No, they determine that.
We're going to be setting aside more for the special project.
from that semester's budget.
Thank you. You only fall in the fall from spring.
The point that I'm trying to make is
30 seconds.
We can't afford the 25% rule in the current way that it's written. I think if we like the spirit of it, we should come up with a process later to clearly articulate how this process should work, not just rush into it, because there's going to come a point where we're going to keep hurting other semesters because we're going to just keep pulling from that and pulling from that for this 25% rule. I totally don't support this whatsoever.
VP Basil.
I think the important thing is that for how difficult the SAC process is, the important thing is that not only does it encourage groups to find passion in whatever the group is about, but it also teaches personal responsibility in getting this budget together. And there's something to be said for that process because, you know, there are a lot of rules that on face value might be ridiculous, but that really is how life works. So I think that's something to keep in mind, too, is that there are deadlines and there are rules. I think that both the office assemblies and the SSC is vehemently opposed to this rule. The experts are opposed to this rule. I think it's clear that we shouldn't pass this amendment. So I'm going to call a question.
Second.
There's been a call to question on the amendment. There's been a second. Is there any dissent to the call to question on the amendment? Okay. Again, to review, the amendment was to strike the last paragraph on the back of the page, page 2, to strike the entire paragraph. I'm not going to read it again.
To unstrike.
To unstrike. But by striking a strike, it's unstrike. So, to unstrike that last paragraph. Any questions? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Handbook?
There's going to be a handbook. Please raise your hand if you're in favor of the amendment.
So yes is unstrike it, no is keep it.
Right. Yes. No? Fine. Please raise, all in favor, please raise your hand. Hi. All opposed? All abstentions? What'd you get? I got 17 to 4 to 0. Excellent. 4 to 17 to 0. So that failed. Going back to the speakers list. On the resolution, Representative Craig.
Yeah, so given that has failed, I voted against it because I think that, I'm going to take your words for it, one of the remarks of it. However, I'm using this time right now to suggest that in looking at the special project idea and in looking at how you're going about doing this, I urge the committee to figure out a way or to work with somebody, figure out a way where there could be some sort of a something, because it's not necessarily defined as it is right now. Unless you guys really know, perhaps we should give the soccer team preference for those, you know, specific going to the tournament. I do feel though that it's a good idea to give students a little bit of a leeway. One of the issues that brought up was, you know, why 1 week? I think 1 week is in that you're allowed to look at the finish line and notice yourself that you suggest you could do that the whole time, but if it's specifically something that you missed, there is a little leeway. We're talking about the first week of school again. You heard from other organizations that that's a little bit difficult.
1 minute.
At this point, I'm interested in hearing more discussion about the resolution, but I urge the committee to figure out a way where students that, you know, maybe have made a mistake because of the other resolution, they're no longer necessarily allowed to appeal, it may not get to us, we would not make that decision ourselves. So there should be something in there where it's, you know, there's a stipulation that students have some options.
Representative Dale Salt.
And tell me just a quick question. Elizabeth, what do you think of during the committee of things like talking more than you want to do things like special funds? But in fact, if these will ease the strain for the basic funds of like obligations, for example, they have basic obligation funds or all those other basic costs, and then all the other costs that come up later, if we're going to say that, scramble to put together the green receiver, for example, the review class, the same time that they need to work together and all that, they eventually spread it over things in the week. So that way, you'll let this process go over the semester. So in October, you can finalize the receiver and then the process. I think that you should continue a reflection on that aspect and how much with that. And I think it goes very well. And on that, I think we can call the question.
Call the question. Second. Maybe second. Okay.
No, second.
Seven seconds. Yeah, we got 2 seconds. Okay, so the clerk, please call the roll. Keep in mind this is the resolution how it is on the sheet. There were no amendments.
Andrew?
Abstain.
Baker?
Yes.
Bailey?
Yes.
Hilton?
Yes.
Craig?
Abstain.
Kuzet?
Yes.
Salonson?
Yes.
Diacap? Yes.
Engelmeyer?
Yes.
Hines? Crossy, yes.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Rack? Yes. Salem?
Yes.
Salmon?
Yes.
Smith? Yes. Shine?
Yes.
Yeah. 17-1-3.
Thank you very much. Resolution 15 passes. Thank you, SHC. Thank you, Art. All right, we have... All right, everyone, focus up. We have an elections rules change. Jackson, elections experience. Oh, no. Sorry. We're postponing the JA policy discussion because we're not going to have enough time. It's not as urgent. Still meeting. Yeah, still meeting. Postponing it because we're not going to have enough time, and I want adequate time for that, and it's not as urgent. And, you know, we like have to get it in for the end of the semester. So that's tabled. Next, we have election rules changes.
Can I go ahead?
Sure, yeah. Elections committee members, can you head up there? Right over there. We will be able to eat right after this, so use that as a motivational factor. Okay. All right, this is new business. The Elections Committee is going to present the Spring 2009 election rules. You have 8 minutes, but don't take that long.
All right, so basically I just wanted to go over what we convene to do. We will do the election rules for the semester coming up, that's the rule of state. So we convened our committee of seniors, representing the UA, SA, and requested outside involvement. We had to incorporate Resolution 12 from last spring, direct request from the president of the UT, and then we come to you to present our recommendations for the spring rules. The process took place over 3 meetings, reviewing the fall election, brainstorming possible options for the director of elections, researching current systems at peer institutions, soliciting input from campus leaders and alumni, inviting SA members to have opportunities to provide their thoughts, comments, and questions prior to the drafting process, and then we proceeded to develop the rules. One thing I would like to say at this moment, a lot of the things you're going to hear today, I know a lot of your concerns are coming from the reasoning that we're here. It's all new. A lot of the things in here are not the traditional rule changes that are made by an election committee. Therefore, if you have a question on pure clarity issues, you just don't understand, and me proceeding further will confuse you, I would like you to quickly stop me and say, I just don't understand what you just said. If it's something that you're going to try to use later in your debate or argue aside or throw the rules, this is not the time for it. But if you honestly have a sincere clarity issue, please stop me so I can answer the question. All right? So we met for 11 hours, 6 o'clock on Saturday. We did receive a lot of input, and we really thank all of you who did give us input. Those were incorporated in the rules, as well as the input from the Office of the Assembly. The Elections Committee stands fully behind this drafted document, and I would like to emphasize that the Elections Committee did not vote on this. This is all consensus. We moved through this process as a consensus process. So therefore, everything here is what the autism community supports. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin with the traditional rule changes. Nothing to do with the recollection of the president or executive vice president. If it's highlighted yellow in your rule, we're not discussing it right now. That will come up in like 2 minutes. Alright, so moving through the document. Article 1, Section A, Subsection 2 is our first change. We have added, candidates may only select up to 2 different paper colors or printed material that are provided by the Office of Assembly. This was a recommendation from the Office of the Assembly, and it was an option. Every single candidate coming in saying, I want 5 of this color, 20 of this color, 30 of this color, creates a burden for them. 2 colors allows them to create a new campaign and lower the burden that the Office of Assembly has to do. Next, Article 1, Section A, Subsection 3. We remove or canvas organization. This removal came from past candidates' frustration with their inability to effectively express their qualifications and on-campus involvement. Yes, Tony, question on clarity.
Clarity, what's the difference between a political coalition and a campus organization?
The political coalition remains for the ability for the elections committee to have decision over 2 different things. One, a strong organization that's for the campaign that is against the rest of the rules of this campaign, and 2, for the, for the Democrats and the Republicans creating some sort of long, large ticket associated with their political organization. The community has more additional.
So,
At least those words that were used in the last year and years referred to tickets, the prevention of tickets. A ticket can't endorse you because there are no tickets for assembly members.
Did I answer your question?
Can I just throw an example and you tell me if I got it right?
Try your example.
So I can say that I'm a member of the SA if I were to run, but I can't say I'm a card-carrying Republican. I have the card in my wallet.
We're deviating from procedure here.
Right.
So why don't we go through? Hold on.
Yeah, one of the clarity.
Go through articles, and then I'll open up a speaker. So we need to have some type of speaker, so we can't just go back and forth.
All right. We're going to move on. Article 1, Section B, Subsection 4, remove and, purely proofreading, if you read it with and, doesn't make sense. Article 1, Section B, Subsection 6, Paragraph B. We remove lists provided by university departments may not be used for campaign purposes, and we change university monitor list of traffic, including those providers supported by university departments, and that's discretion of list of owners. The election committee found that the previous 2 separate rules were first in discussion and found to be redundant, and then just contradictory and then just confusing. We did not understand the rules regarding listers. We believe that this is much easier to understand for the listers and will allow for candidates to have flexibility to use in their candidacy and their campaign regarding listers, but it does still allow the discretion of the lister owner. Moving on, Article 1, Section B, Subsection 7. The introduction area has been changed. The Office of Assembly is assuming the candidates who do not submit a receipt and or proof of fair market value have spent $0 on their campaign. The election committee found the previous rule overly strict and unnecessary with the potential for quick and immediate disqualification of candidates that would result in unfilled seats. So we think that this will give more leeway and relationships will come back later too. The next one, Article 1, Section B, Subsection 7, Paragraph B is underlined. It's not a change. My computer underlined it and went off underlined here. It's not a change. Article 1, Section B, Subsection 8, Paragraphs A and B. We deleted organizations receiving money directly or indirectly from the student assembly may not donate money or request candidates. Further directed by an unfunded organization receiving money from the undergraduate student activity fee are prohibited from endorsing their campaign for or against a candidate. We've changed to SAFC funded organizations may endorse candidates. Director Washington will encourage, but you guys can read it. But basically what this is it allows the ability for endorsing to occur in an open and easy forum. It's going to allow for, again, creativity and flexibility on candidates for the campaigning. It's still allows for all SASC funding organizations to receive some sort of direction. The director of elections will be sending an email on what is fair and balanced. And then for the SAF filing funding group, they must still do the 48 hours notice if they wanted to endorse it. It again allows them the opportunity to endorse. Prior to endorsement, they have to offer all candidates an opportunity to speak. So we think that we'll be flexible to candidates and student organizations and fit within fair and balanced rules. Those are the end of Article 1 changes.
Okay, I'm opening up the speakers list for Article 1 questions. I have a list. Representative Stein.
So I know that this has received a lot of discussion, but I'm curious to hear some of the reasons why you decided to reintroduce tickets. I know this has been a really
hard time. We're not discussing tickets.
Well, for president and vice president.
No, I'm sorry. We're not discussing presidential tickets right now, and
I think that Mike established in the beginning, we're first going through the changes that are not related to this presidential slate
right
yet.
Okay, so...
Just the rules we just went over. The changes we just went over.
What are we discussing
that? Just underlying but not yellow. Just what an election committee would traditionally be the rules.
No, I understand. What are we discussing the yellow?
Immediately following.
Sounds good. Okay.
Let me make a point. It's most likely going to be next week because we have a scheduled session with the consultants at 6. So
right.
That's why we structured it like this. D.P. Miller, I have your thing.
Can you answer my question now that I asked you earlier?
Ask it again.
Yes.
So, again, on my written statement, I am allowed to say that I was a member of the student assembly, but I can't say that I'm a Republican. Is that correct or incorrect?
There's nothing in the rules that say you can't announce an affiliation with a political party.
So what's
the whole organization goes back to Ryan's answer of, in the past, there have been tickets on campus that's still not allowed in the rules.
Okay. So it's not about, it's not political in the sense of national political. So I could tell you that I'm not, but I could tell you that I'm a member of the Cornell Democrats.
I give you clarity, and for clarity, the answer is yes. Political organization is left in there because we don't want to
take it. Okay.
Representative Craig.
I guess that was my question. And you crossed out our campus organization, so say student Democrats.
Like a political coalition like Change for Cornell
Let me pause. Okay, so when you have, this is like a piece of legislation, right? So you need to look at the text in the sense of legislative history, which these two words were put in there to refer to tickets, clean slate, university voice. It's up to the judicial part, the elections committee, to really decide ultimately, given the election, what that does pertain to. If a given election has a lot of issues going on with CU Dems and CU Republicans, which has been in the past, that's up to the judicial branch of the election system, which is the elections committee at that point, to interpret it how they may.
So then my question is, political coalitions is strictly like, you know, Change for Cornell and then five individuals on the ballot page, Change for Cornell. That's not allowed.
Right, and it's also, that's through all other rules
violated. There's a variety of rules that are violated.
Okay. But you can't say Team Democrats and having five Team Democrats.
That was the history when this, right.
Yeah,
I can't, I'm trying to be unbiased here, but we got to.
We are allowing student organizations to be back on the list because there was numerous past candidates who identified that they had issues figuring out ways to say that they were on the student assembly or that they had a leadership role in something. Instead, they were making up words to try to express what they've done on campus. And all they were doing was insinuating the same thing that they could have done much easier by saying, I have served on the university.
Representative Ress.
Okay, I just have a question about a point. So when you say that if you spent $0, you just don't turn in anything and then that's fine.
Okay.
So how do you know if someone just forgot to turn it in?
We're going to be coming to that little change in a little bit.
Okay.
And that's why I said the relationship between this role and the role.
Okay, then I have another question. About the Facebook Marjorie, I was confused about this when I read in the fall. It says that candidates are associated only as being on the behalf of, say, from standing for the government, etc. But if you use
to say a courthouse 2012 and you can't do that. Now I have standing for the other problem.
That's the question that would have to go in front of the election committee of challenge overall. However, if you can identify you were a friend of that person, they is no longer stand.
Okay. For the point citation, yeah, but in the past or whatnot, have seen in the same Facebook group, kind of these team or something.
that's the, you mean for the whole ticket issue? That
no, I don't mean in how do you clarify knowing someone?
I can tell you that on other election committee I've served on following rules similar to these, that has occurred. But it is the precedent and history of the election committee of the SA and the judicial thought process of the election committee of the SA that has the ability to determine that. The reason for this is that you couldn't go and message everyone on Facebook. That's what the rule's trying to tell.
All right, this comes from Ava. How is this different than sending all this?
Do you want to yield your time? You can yield your time to Ava.
Yeah.
Okay, sure.
30 seconds.
Okay, so again, I guess you can't message all of Facebook, but I'm just wondering if people join the group that's taking from messaging.
A lizard is an email that is sent through an organization and there is a distinct owner of that lizard. To use a lizard, you must have permission from the owner of the lizard to access it. Facebook is a social networking group that does not have a distinct owner of the ability to send or receive messages within a group.
Okay. Representative Engelmar. No? Hey.
Wait, I don't have time to... Emma. I have a question along the same line. So if you don't own a lizard, but you're on a lizard, can you send it?
That comes in the functionality of the listserv. If you have the function within your listserv that everyone's considered an owner and has the ability to send or receive, most listservs will let that happen. Owner of the listserv is usually the president or the webmaster of the organization. Following the rules, it would probably be best to always email that person and ask their permission to send out an email on your behalf. That is what I hope. Always recommended to any candidate to follow these rules.
Representative Dale Alsop.
So if the owner of a listserv that's allowed one candidate to send out an email with a statement that they're saying vote for me, but decides not allowed another candidate to do it on no basis,
that's always been the discretion of the listserv owner, and that's always been in our rules. So it could work that way.
On that note, I just want to make a point here. It's important that you look at, if these are the rules, it's also important to look at precedent. Like, if I'm on a listserv that I'm in a fraternity and I send it, there's been no precedent where someone actually is challenged and punished in an election system like that. Yes, these rules are in place to give the appropriate power of the elections committee to enforce a fair election, but you know, all these questions kind of hit on stuff that has really no precedent for people really getting in trouble. That's all I'm saying.
And I can absolutely tell you a lot of your questions are very justified, and the majority of these have all been discussed by the election committee. So, finally, bringing up these points of clarity.
Yep, Representative Salem.
Yeah, I understand that the reason they added or kept the position is not to give them incumbents and investors. So, I was wondering if you think that this would give people already on the incumbent that you already know to be able to crack all of
this. I don't believe so. The rules clearly say that someone on the SA can't be using their position on the SA to help their campaign prior to campaign beginning. It's in the petitioning rule. If you're going to be a student leader and you're going to run an effective campaign, you are going to sell yourself to working down on campus. And this allows someone that's on the student assembly or on any other organization to be able to justify their qualifications without having to be around the bush. Someone in the student assembly in the past said I was a member of student government. That's how they got around it. For all of us, it seems like they were insinuating the exact same thing they could have said in the student assembly, and it would have been a more informed voter populace had they been able to read the true justification for these persons.
I'm going to move on to the second speaker's list, unless there's anyone that wants to speak that has not. Okay, Representative Craig. VP Miller.
So I know when we met at the first elections meeting, I know I specifically asked you about endorsements of candidates running. And I spoke to a member of the elections committee, and they said that it wasn't explicitly put down here, but I'm curious what you took away from that meeting and how you would apply the rules to candidates who, although they cannot put another candidate's name on their written statement, I completely understand that, although they cannot be on the Supreme Court, I completely understand that, are they allowed to support each other?
Yeah.
In the campaign
because you had a, Tony asked a question of, some sort of I'm in their Facebook group, they're in my Facebook group, which is kind of, that's something that the election really decided came to a discussion of the endorsement rules, and if there was a challenge on it, it would be the election committee to determine minor versus major violations. There's absolutely no way the election committee can go through, especially with today's technology, and exclude everything. So instead, it's an ability to have Ryan set, make a set of rules that allow them to have a judicious process in deciding who committed violations and who was acting fairly and unfairly. So I think that's where the question can be stood on a more direct question.
That you'll take it on a case-by-case basis.
That for something as simple as I happen to be in the same Facebook group as someone else without getting on the printed materials and using the same slogan, that would be a case-by-case basis. Triggered by someone's
time. And follow up with that.
30 seconds.
Fine. Can a candidate act as an agent of another candidate during the election cycle?
And can I say something about you? Or
as in, let's say that Ryan and I are both running for SA, and I want to stand out on Hope Plaza and tell everyone of my friends that Ryan Lively will do a great job in the system, and I hope you vote for him. Am I allowed to do that?
That would violate no one distributing.
I'm not going to distribute a quarter card. I'm not going to cut this quarter card.
Again, that came back down to the discussion of the election. Again, overall, the election committee would like to have a flexible and creative campaigning process in the future. There have been numerous restrictions which, for the candidates, and organizations on campus have instilled fear of what I can't do, and a conception of I can't find help in this area. The rules for the endorsement that you're asking, those rules are actually in the restrictions section of the rule. They're number 10 restrictions. That's where any rules relative to what you're saying asking what a candidate can do. So those rules stand historically as they've always been, the president stands as well.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to stop now because the speaker's list is exhausted, and I want you all to get food before the consultants, I guess, are ready. So we will continue this next week after Thornton and Susan Murphy speak, and we will have to settle it.
Is it possible maybe that the chairman's question can have a separate meeting? Have to vote on it?
Yes. Yes. I, if we don't pass the semester, we're going to have a special meeting.
Well, yeah, I'm just saying, is that before the end of the meeting?
Oh, before. I can entertain that. Sure. Yes.
Yeah, well, we're going to be like this. Yeah, okay.
conflict of goddamn rules.
Thank you.
it is, but don't worry, it's legit.
Yeah.
So, what's worse, being colored or being colored?
I would much rather be colored.
You know how much I like that.
No, oh, it's still recording.
Guys, we're going to start now, so if everyone can take your seat. Okay, great. Welcome back. The meeting should not go till 7:30, but we are technically here till then. We are technically here till then. So, we're going to open it up to our next item on the agenda, Campus Life Focus Group. So, in conjunction with the University Master Plan, Department of Campus Life, Cornell Dining, and all residential programs, Campus Life, they have hired a consulting firm to, I guess, advise on the master plan relating to residential programs and dining. So that's what we're going to be talking about today in this focus group. So welcome. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for providing us with dinner. We appreciate that. So I guess please introduce yourself. You can take a seat right up here on this table. Please introduce yourself. A brief overview of the process of what you guys were tasked to do and how we can help would be great.
And you're going to be the first guinea pig. Normally we do individual focus groups, but this is the first joint one. So we're ringing.
Well, let me start by giving some background into who I am and what I do, and giving some background into Edith and what he does, and then give you an overview of why we're here at Cornell. So, my name is Katie Carr. I am a project coordinator with a facility planning firm called Braille Fertility, and we're based out of Washington, D.C., but we also have offices in Chicago, Florida, California, Ohio. As facility planners, we're not architects, so we don't design the building, although some of us have architectural backgrounds. What we do is kind of the data analysis and market analysis behind a new facility, or in this case, a master plan. So what we do is we focus on what we call quality of life facilities. So a lot of that is in higher education. We've been at universities in 48 of the 50 states. So we do a lot of universities, work with a lot of students, faculty, staff, administrators to bring student housing, student unions, and student recreation centers, in some cases academic centers, to a campus or improve the facilities that they already have. So that's a little bit about who I am and what I do.
Hi there. My name is Ben Moreno. I'm the managing director of Trust Hall IN for food service planning. We have been engaged to our school of people wanting to serve the long-term master planning as it relates to the dining service. However, we're also looking for the strategic planning that and ensure that the program is moving
today is to talk with you in our housing master plan team and in the guidance that we need. The housing master plan, now that the North Residential Initiative and the West Residential Initiative are in place and in talk, They invited us to work on a with the university on a comprehensive housing master plan. Take a look at where Cornell is now in respect to the housing facilities, as experienced with peers, as students complete it, and help plan where you can go over the next 20 years. So what we want to do, and why we're here today, and why I'm here today, is to involve the key stakeholders at a university campus to pursue it. See a true feedback about what's working well, what's not, what needs to be improved as we move forward to the next phase of housing and dining. So maybe if you could just go around the room and give us your name, what major you're in, and whether you live on or off campus.
And whether what?
What are you doing?
All right. Do you want me to? Okay. Good.
I'm my name is Lee Duke, and I'm a senior at Cornell, and I live off campus in a
company. My name is Gabe Gray. I'm a scientist. I was on last year in the dorm, and I'm just here in the program now. And I'm also on the university. I'm a senior, I live off campus, and a student.
My name is Natalie Rapp. I'm a freshman and I live on North, and I do on the
My name is Mike Thomas. I'm a senior. I'm in the and I live on North. I'm there now, and my first name representative is in Clark and Mary. I live on campus, and I'm home in the year. Now, you're in the year.
I'm Clinton Andrews. I'm an industrial regulations major. And I live in Greenfield with my parents, but it's owned by my house.
On campus.
Andrew Brockman. I live on campus too, and I'm part of that traditional business plan.
My name is Theo Kumar. I'm a sophomore at the Iowa School. And I live on campus on West Texas and I'm on campus.
My name is Nate. I'm a sophomore and I'm my second year in the dormitory on campus.
My name is Becca. I'm an ILR. I'm a sophomore. I do not live on campus and I do not have a real plan.
Hi, my name is Nikki Janowitz. I'm a junior. I do live on campus and I have a meal plan as well.
Hi, I'm Tony Miller. I'm a junior and I do not live on campus nor do I have a meal plan.
Ryan Lavin. I'm off campus and I'm not on a meal plan.
Chris Basil, I'm an econ major. I live off campus in a fraternity, and I do have like a basic big red box meal plan.
Greg Mundy, I'm a senior in the hotel school. I live in a university-owned fraternity house, and I do have a meal plan.
My name is Scott. I'm a junior in engineering. I live in a university-owned fraternity house on the west, and I do not have a meal plan.
Oh, hi, my name is Rebecca Stein. I'm not sure if my house is owned by Cornell or not. I don't think it is. And I have a basic meal plan.
Hi, I'm Alex Patella, a junior in the Ag School, and I do not live on campus, nor do I have a meal plan.
I'm a strategic. I'm a freshman in ILR, so I am on campus and I'm in the school. Hi, I'm Lauren.
Be merit based. I'll give them up.
Unbiased.
Now there is exactly
Approximately.
Voting number.
Anybody does not get your name and number because you will be away. And
all right.
All right.
Thank you.
So our discussion tonight is very informal. Don't feel that you need to really raise your hand. We just ask that you respect each other's comments and don't talk over one another so that we can have all the ways to get the table heard. Maybe you could just start by telling us why you decided to come to Cornell.
All right, that speaker's lessons.
Okay.
Evelyn.
One of the reasons I decided to come to Cornell is actually that I was playing rugby before, and I no longer do that because of all the opportunities that happened. But also, it was reason number one in dining was kind of a plus. I'm not going to lie, that really worried me, and I like that everyone wins, all the freshmen win together at work is also a religious plus. One of the drawbacks to me actually was that people would be getting to move on campus, but that's okay with me because everyone was still kind of together all in college camp. So I know that for me personally, like I did like that it was like not a year campus by any means, that there were doors like areas where you can live with your class for most of the year. Others?
I came because it was the best for what I wanted to do. I mean, they have the best hospitality program in the country, some would argue the world. So that's why I came.
Yeah, I was here at Cornell during Cornell days. I was supposed to go overnight. I like that all the questions were together. I did know that Cornell, all the weather was good.
I mean, I guess for me, like Greg, I mean, I came in as a bio major. Cornell is a very strong bio program. But I think that, I mean, when I was choosing from the schools I was admitted to, the quality of both housing and, you know, Cornell has a reputation for having very good dining, stuff like that. That was all stuff that I noted and I considered, but I think when it came down to it for me, obviously academics is a more important criteria. So I think that for some schools, what I considered sort of substandard housing would have been a disqualifier, but I don't think that many students would attend colleges purely based on, you know, housing and dining.
So for those reasons and all others, has Cornell met, exceeded, or fallen short of your expectations in terms of all campus life, not just housing or dining, but involvement of housing on campus, support of housing off campus, ability to meet people, academic programs?
I think one thing I would say is that while College Town is very close and a large number of us live in College Town, there is a disconnect between College Town life and campus. And you cross that bridge, you're going on a campus and you return to College Town, you're in College Town. And I think that integration of campus and campus services into College Town would be beneficial for everyone that lives there.
I really think the North Campus Initiative, I'm a freshman, so I just think that's really great because that helps me meet people my own age. And we've got people around with some of the same issues that I'm having as a freshman, and I just think that's definitely one of the things that I'm, of Cornell, like, I'm hearing back in perspective that we're all kind of in it together at the same time.
In terms of, I've only lived on campus 1 year, and I live on North Campus, but it exceeded my expectations compared to, you know, I visited friends in other colleges who were freshmen at the time when I was a freshman. Their dorms were nothing like ours. Their dining facilities were incredibly less impressive than our dining facilities were by far. And in terms of off-campus, obviously, when I was in school off-campus, you know, I live in College Town now, and that's not very impressive at all.
I personally was a transfer, and so just coming and seeing the quality of dining here with other schools was definitely very impressive. One of the things I was very disappointed with, though, was as a transfer, I expected to live in a transfer center, which had just been knocked down the year before I came. And I was placed in Hasbrook, which was great. We had apartments, we loved them, but we weren't really as close to a dining facility as most of the other, you know, students living on campus would be.
and when it snowed, it was really enough of a walk that I didn't even use the 7 or 10 meal per semester I had.
And what year were you in?
A sophomore.
Just to kind of piggyback a little bit, I think overall campus life has done a great job. I mean, the opportunities for involvement and all that type of thing is great. I think there's a little pockets for improvement. I was a transfer as well. I transferred in the fall of 2006. So I did know what a transfer center was. I didn't live there. I was in one of the buildings that they knocked down before the transfer center, then got moved to some of the West Campus houses. But I think that they've done a great job creating these different initiatives, but I think they have neglected to focus on transfer-specific needs and how to best meet those needs. I think some people in residential life have thought about it, but I don't think they've thought about it enough as they should have. So that would be my one point.
I was And it's a great time about it. And one thing that kind of surprised me was how Cornell was overcrowded last year, started with more compression and accepted. So I was kind of disappointed to see that it wouldn't be common rooms that they can close off and all that stuff and campus life issues. That if it was a common room, you can use them solid, you expect to have no room, and they have a room to find yourself in common, and that's that fits for it.
Well, this will bring them to the university, but I've been in their zone. I definitely love Cornell zone more and the region zone in Connecticut. But still, I think there's some initiatives I'm considering. Like, as an international student, all the houses are closed down with the university. So, for most of us were staying here for the winter break. We don't have a place to live. And living in HLC is very expensive, and I feel that it is only really long instead of in the system. I think like international students, they won't go home during Christmas and New Year, they're long here without parents. So I think this is this would be apparently more fair.
What are some of the reasons that students choose to live on campus?
I think that for me, having moved off campus, you really appreciate things like having someone cleaning consistently and stuff like that. But so I mean, there's just you expect a certain level of service almost from the university.
I personally would like to be able to take advantage of campus housing next year. Unfortunately, I hear I probably won't have that opportunity since I would be at the end of the housing lottery. But one of the reasons I hear from a lot of people is they don't want to deal with subletting. And I know personally, you know, if I end up not spending a full year on campus, the last thing I'd want to do is deal with subletting in Ithaca. Another thing just to mention is that Cornell housing and dining are exorbitantly expensive, especially in comparison to other schools.
Yeah, I was going to say, why is that even something we should do on campus? I think working through the doors, providing the community, working for, meeting with, you know, groups of students that they do, other students that are going to be on campus. And I do want to reiterate, I mean, as a freshman, I had many times a lot of respect, so I was going to say, my community friends to say. And that doesn't affect, you know, the experience, but just have to work a little bit harder. But people definitely want to be on campus, want to serve services better, and they're giving it off to the community and, you know, the areas that are there.
To piggyback off that, I think how College Town is College Town community. There's the West Campus, which is the on-campus community, and then there are Greek houses, which are considered on-campus, but then that's a different type of community. And each have distinct, like, personalities. The communities have different personalities. If a community can have a personality. So I think some people find the personality associated with on-campus more appealing than others. It attracts different types of people, I think. I'm making generalizations that obviously maybe some people might not agree with, or, you know, they are generalizations, but I think that's a large factor of how people choose.
I was a transfer student this year, and right now I'm trying to talk to the housing people. I know the director, Barbara Romano, over there, and we're trying to figure out, like, transfers right now are dispersed throughout the 5 houses on West Campus, 3 months of them. They have only 300 square beds, and there's like 2,000, something like that. And the other 160 of them are dispersed on North Campus, 120 of which are in apartment-style living with freshmen on North Campus, which the distance between West Campus and where they are in the apartments, you have to go literally up a hill, cross a bridge, up another hill.
Through the woods.
And, you know, with...
Unless they're coming to you.
And so, I mean, I think we should, if there's going to be no more transfer center, which, you know, it only had 200 spots in there to begin with when they knocked it down. But if there's not going to be a transfer center, I think at least those 160 other transfers shouldn't be like, up there in the hills with, you know, the other 75% down south.
I think now that I live off campus, I realize the best thing about living on campus is all of the land. To me, the worst thing about living in college is not like if I just want to go get outside and see the water, I literally have no idea where to go. So I think, obviously part of what's the best thing about Cornell is, you know, our landscape and how gorgeous it is. So I think it's really important that, you know, all housing has somewhere to go where you can, like, enjoy the outdoors. And then, I mean, I guess, I don't think they're both from college town, but.
So for those of you that live off campus, what are some of the reasons why you decided to move off campus?
So I actually, I've lived off campus for 3 years now. I think that there are three main reasons. I like the economy and not having an RA. I kind of like the separation of, you know, where I live versus where I take classes. And I think that, you know, North to Central, you know, has some of that separation, but I think College Town really deals with completely the same. I like having my a single bedroom, which is guaranteed in College Town. And I like kind of the urban feel of College Town. I live in the town of my freshman year. And you're just like, way out of the game or whatever you like. And I didn't have
kind of urban
vibe. Because I have people who live in my town, I have the people in my town around me. So that was really a good experience. Also, with middle time, I think that you'll hear a lot of intercommons between the seniors before a year and the freshmen before a year. When it was my freshman year, and all the other 2 years too, living on that campus was kind of uncool because there were all these like ugly dorms, they were like falling apart. So like, it was really viewed as like, you don't really want to live there, right? So like, living a lot of time was cool to do. I think that that's really changing now that West Campus is really in our own.
I'd say, we mentioned it before, one of the main things is coffee counseling, and I just find it interesting to speak to them, and so next year will be my first year off campus. But, so, one thing that I think about is living across. Another thing is the students, such as myself, who are, you know, have to have the way the housing system works, and looking at, you know, what are my options to do where I want to be, being a student, you know, am I going to be left in a place? Is it possible that as a junior I'm going to have to stay out, you know, with freshmen, or am I going to be disconnected from our community? Another thing is that as you, I guess, move up to the ranks, more and more people start either joining the community or going to college now. And it just seems like, I mean, you have the impression that, okay, now that I'm coming, you know, this year, it's time for me to start living in this. I think that's part of that culture that we have, which is
I'm going back to something that you said. You said in college time you're guaranteed a single bedroom. Is that only that all are offered, or is that something that you're missing way too?
You can probably find rooms that you could have, but I would say like 95% of the rooms I've seen in all of my college courses all 3 years.
It's going to be organized your week. I mean, I had an option for it level. And one of the cheaper is good. In college, again, the city down there. So basically, in a house, you rent a house, you fit 5 people in there, and then you have, you know, 5 rooms and 5 people. If you decide to make it cheaper and bring 8 people in, something like that, you'll have to do whatever you need to do to make it work.
So, where are students living off campus? Other than college town, big drop?
Greek houses?
Greek houses.
were pretty much the two. But no one lives downtown in Ithaca. Generally, prices down there tend to be a lot cheaper because it seems that college town landlords have controlled the rent over the past 2 years. It's skyrocketed, doubled and tripled in some cases. So you can find, you know, for half to a third the price if you're living downtown, but nobody wants to walk up the hill, you know.
I actually have a couple friends that live at Ithaca College because on average it's $300 to $350 less per month to rent the house on the other hill.
Where it's even cheaper downtown.
Right.
Yeah.
So most people are living in college town. Are people that are not living in college town agreed? Are they renting houses that have been converted to apartments?
Yeah,
for the most part.
That's college town.
I'd say it's half and half. There's some of the buildings that are all apartment buildings, and then there's a ton of houses that you can also rent.
There's also apartments on West Campus and North, too, which are typically cheaper. I think college towns, everyone's living so badly that they can sort of afford to charge students more. I think it's called, I've heard of different places like Campus Hill and Gun Hill. They're very nice, and seem that a lot of them seem to be almost half the price of what some people are paying in college towns. So it's kind of, I guess, it's nice and fun that you can pick and choose, but I think that that's sort of, it's funny to see how different such price differences are among off campus.
About how much are people paying off campus?
I know Brian and I both pay approximately $600 a month.
Yeah.
Also, did you say before, I think just to make clear, you were kind of mentioned three houses and people off campus. I think that actually campus is very popular for students who are great but aren't living in their houses. And for all the majority, only sophomores live in their houses for the most part. So most great juniors and seniors, at least for the female ones, I would say more college. I think once you move off campus, more interest really has to be.
Actually, Kate, I know a lot of people who would like the option of living on for one semester during their junior year because they're going abroad or they're doing credit internships. But again, now that they're being placed at the end of the lottery, don't see it as an option.
Yeah, I guess so.
But as a whole, like, you're definitely correct.
So what are some of the amenities and services that if we're renovating or building any kind of new building, we should keep in mind that students are going to want?
Social space, common space. That's not for 25 or more.
Is Cornell looking to get bigger, like enlarge dorms and lots of more rooms on campus or not?
That's part of what our reason has to tell them is if there's a demand for more beds on campus. They feel that the number of students they have living on campus right now would be adequate for the university and their value. But if there's student demand driving the entire bed time, they're willing to create the bed.
Well, I think there's obvious demand, there's a shortage. I mean, that 2,000 people who sign up for the lottery and then get stuck with bad options they don't want and just drop out. That happens to only 2,000 kids, so I think more beds would definitely be put to use here.
In terms of expanding everything, I think amenities should be sort of consistent across the system. For example, I have a place in one of the cops on West Campus. And that was needed vendor house, which was grand. There was that pantry even though we're paying the same price, the amenities is
very. There's no price differential if you're not in one of the core five. There are a couple of those gothics, which are really old buildings that they kind of attach to, as they call it, whatever tower, Dallas Hotel.
But there is an internal connection to those houses now.
Only the other going to the house.
So I was in
high-rises,
and I feel like the family gets a lot of amenities and all the other places have, Muse and all the newer ones. When I go there, they have a menu that seems up after the school. Like, in their bathrooms and stuff, they have a lot more pretty things. They have newer appliances, really three of our ovens don't work and don't have any form, any dial, we can't move it. And on the high rises, you can't go in through the stairs and you can't go from the ground to any other floor. So it's kind of very socially limiting. So stuff like that, if you're going to make really, really nice houses for fashion, you should only make them for everyone. And the same goes for fashion and happy living townhouses as well. If you're going to put these beds, you might as well make a new floor for more.
I think one of the big things, like a lot of times when we talk about building new spaces and things, I think the details are so important. For example, soap dispensers. I know this is, it's something so trivial, but to not put a soap dispenser in a bathroom in a residence hall seems like there's some disconnect somewhere. It's supposed to be a clean, friendly, safe environment, all those types of things. It has great common rooms and great carpet and lights and wall colors and all that stuff, but there's no soap dispenser in the bathroom. So focusing on details, and I know it's probably a cost savings, but at the same time, those are the little things that kind of, I would say, infuriate or rally the troops to do something about it.
I think you're looking for more abstract golden comment, but whatever. I wanted to, this probably was mentioned, and I know it was mentioned this morning. So like College Town already has a community that, you know, a third of undergraduate students perhaps live in College Town, I'm not entirely sure, but in terms of, you know, making the investment, you asked if there a demand for more on campus, you know, if there were more beds put in on-campus dorms, you know, would they be filled? Probably, but I think a better investment is to, for example, put a College Town Community Center in College Town with a fitness center and university-provided amenities and so forth. That's a better investment. You're raising the standard of living for students there in a much more productive way. So I think it's less, you know, more on campus. It should be one of the goals, but investing in the communities they already are at B, not they might not necessarily be, you know, university controlled.
And last comment, then we'll bring it over to Ed.
Sorry, yeah, I totally agree with what Ryan just said. I live in Pasadena, which is, you probably know, is one of the residence halls within College Town, which is really great. I really like living there. But it's kind of weird because it's like, I've lived in on campus housing the past 2 years as well, and all the other, I feel like, living communities, whether it be like North Campus or West, they sort of have noise or RPU, they do have community centers. And it's funny because I really do feel that lacking in College Town. I think it would be nice to have some kind of, I know that there's tons of, you know, off-campus kind of dining facilities there, but it would be nice to have like some form of dining hall or a place to use cigarette box or meal plan. So students living in the residence halls there can still use a meal plan and not have to walk, you know, all the way to West or whatever. So I don't know, that just going after that, I think that would be like wonderful.
I know that this is kind of minor, but I've heard a lot of people say that the new dorms are not aesthetically pleasing from the outside, as nice as they are once you get inside.
I'm sorry, from what?
The outside of the new dorms. I've heard them described as looking like prisons by several people. I personally wouldn't take it that far, but perhaps to make new buildings blend in with the general campus a little bit more.
Thank you.
Just one more time, I'm a member of Focus Hour. We don't really don't need to have a special car for taking an elevator or going up there. It was very important. Like when we are in the dorm, we are not like sharing our cars all the time. So from a dining perspective, I've heard a couple of things. What I want to explore a little bit is general thoughts around Cornell dining, your satisfaction level with Cornell dining. For those of you that are or have been on a meal plan, satisfaction level with it, some of the issues that we may have faced, some of the reasons why you may not be on a meal plan now. I want to have a brief discussion around the retail operations on campus. Are they meeting your needs, and are they appropriately located? Are they the right type of facility?
then I want to explore a little bit for those, given the amount of people that live off campus, what is it that people go to? And even where do they live off campus? So that's the broad theme of where we want to begin. I'd like an open forum with just general thoughts around learning services, strengths, and needs. Yes.
Oh, okay. I know for me, I'm a sophomore, so last year I had a freshman. I was disappointed with designing. I think
you
that
lived in North?
Yes, okay. I did. I lived on North. I probably like to eat healthier than a lot of students, and I was disappointed with the variety of healthy options that there were, which is why I decided not to be on the meal plan this year.
Okay. Was that the number one reason for not renewing? Was just the lack of healthy
food? Oh, well, and it's expensive.
Okay. That's that.
Two side notes. I was only on a meal plan for a year and a half. I got out of it halfway through my sophomore year. But one of the things I really like, and I wasn't allowed to be involved with it because I wasn't in, like, Alan Kirchhoff or one of them, and it's not implemented that well, but the idea is really great. This walk-in pantry for residents of the house. All the new houses on West are supposed to have some sort of pantry where leftover food is brought up and you can use your card access to get in the evening. And I've been to a couple other schools that have the same thing that actually do a better job keeping stock. And it's a really great idea, even just having that free coffee available. One of the things is, and this was when I lived on North Campus as a freshman, during exam week, you have exams that start at 9 a.m. on Saturday. There are no breakfast areas open for you to go to prior to your exam. Early morning is not something that's catered to very well, except for areas that a lot of staff are commuting into. So it's pretty on that early morning.
Here, first of all, it's a role of meal plan, and it's a problem that I've been carrying on my 2 years. And it's pretty straightforward that people are wasting meal plan every single week. I know there's a lot of freshmen. I know there are certain other Ivy colleges and other state colleges who are doing the role of meal plan, so I'm just wondering why and how can I do it. And according to Representative Dong last year, they say that now dining in Sweden is after what she has stable, like there's a specific demand so that we can control it and go with through. So, like, I mean, things is on practice, our overall meal plan is on practice out of big colleges. I'm just not sure how many options are going to be. Yeah, and another initiative is about sharing it with NPR. I think there's no other restaurant around Asia. I think mine is already time here, though it's a quite wide one to make treating a meal sandwich for.
I don't think many people would like that. I know personally, I go to Trillium regularly. I knew a lot of people who would never go there if they had to use a $14, maybe 5 cent meal plate.
I don't know if you
still. So maybe not Trillium, but have some sort of option.
Yeah, like
in the slot for people who are on the
That's an important question about what Yao was just saying. Did you say that there's not many other options around the Ag Quad?
You're saying to my knowledge.
Okay, yes. I think maybe the one thing that campus dining might be able to do is publicize the other options, because I can name three, four.
No, you also
need
all you can eat.
Oh, okay, but other places. So yeah, the only one, I guess, would be Open Children. But also publicity.
Generally speaking, I think I'm very satisfied with all the dining facilities on campus. And I visit friends off campus, and it's like a different world. It's bizarre. Our standard of dining is really good. One thing that I'm sort of sorry about, I really like how the West campuses are, the dining halls are structured. They're better. They're kind of like a smaller RPU and Appel dining hall, I found. They're the same quality. They're just smaller. Okay, this is what I'm envisioning. Let me gather my thoughts. So for lunch, lunch is something that's very, I'd say, inconsistent. So, some people don't have it. Some people you're on Central Campus all day. Some people don't have it. Some people rush, and because there's not a lot of meal options, like you said, yeah, it's kind of grab and go kind of thing. That's just, I guess, the mentality of the Cornell day anyway. But I think it'd be really awesome if, you know, there are kind of set lunch times where there aren't classes, where you go back to those halls or wherever they are, to those dining halls and have a sit down lunch as a, I don't know, I think it kind of is just more community feeling, and it's just a nice break in the day. So if the dining program can kind of like foster that, I think that'd be really nice. I know it's kind of a abstract plan.
I promise this has a room that I'm going to come back to.
I'm thrilled with the quality of the food here. I think the biggest problem is the flexibility. I would absolutely love to be on one, but I'm not going to be here next semester, so to have invested in a
so flexibility for semester also, but in terms of flexibility, the structure of your time?
Yes, there is no
what was the question?
You can't.
You can get like the bigger books and stuff, but I don't think you can get a meal plan with the number.
No, any big red box, the minimum is huge.
It's $250 and like $10. So it comes out to like $380 some.
Wait,
is there a college town meal plan?
Can I ask a question? How do you get information around meals?
Online. Dining.cornell.edu.
How do you find the dining website?
Through Resident Life.
Is it user friendly? Is it getting the kind of information you need?
Better.
Because like it's so easy to go on there and like reload BRBs and do all that kind of stuff. Maybe I know a lot of
people. I think it's a great website.
And what are you using it for? Is it obviously reloading? What else are you using the website for?
Trying to figure out if anything is open anymore.
Hours,
yeah.
I think the big thing, and I know they're trying to work on this, is putting like the schedules, like the 3-week rotations up, so you can see what's being offered at what day, at what time, in which one of the dining operations, because they run on cycle menus.
Sure.
So put those menus up so you can see, you know, because if you love, you know, Becker House chicken wings, you want to know when that day is.
Sure.
There's a chicken wing. But,
one thing I really like about the West Campus is now, and I kind of agree that one of my favorite ideas is how they're integrating with Golden House and having a college professor and then just like visiting professors and sure. For dinner. I think that idea is really nice. I think it builds like a really great community, even if you have to take some of your professors and just like, you know, chat with them. I think that's nice. So I really like that model. I would also like to connect with something that was earlier, like, you know, I really want to be in the food and the dining hall. Would it advertise healthy? It's not.
Okay, so what do you think there's a lack in terms of health?
I thought if they had a challenge that they would have like an entry one. This is something I think you're doing. So they always have a challenge. They think they have a challenge. People should have been kind of like you're doing like the but protein for a little bit of they have like, you know, the kind of like chicken and like rolling burgers. One thing that I noticed around the campus is that there's not a lot of lactose intolerance options. In all the libraries and stuff, if you just want like a yogurt, you can't really have one because they're really freaking lactose. Like soy yogurt and in the dining hall, it takes forever to get someone to get you your lactate like milk or whatever. So there's not even options. You have to have 100%
Yeah, I think Zach has done a really good job at balancing the vegetarian option. Pretty much every dining hall seems to be a vegetarian
Come on.
a really good option that a lot of people may not know about, and that might be a reason that I'm like more happy with their aspect. Do I think I'm looking for the same thing? Not only like I don't know, even if she's like saying I don't like those non.
I was just kind of saying that, but I think that what the Dining Hall offer is really comprehensive, that not a lot of people know about it, especially freshmen. We're like, really? The fried tofu again? Kind of thing. Like, if you're looking for, like, an option like that, like, I know, I need my groceries, but I'm kind of not big eaters, red eaters, and so I don't totally get that fried tofu. It's just, like, some people don't know the options that you can go get, as a chicken piece of fish. Like, if you somehow advertise that, and, like, when you're entering Cornell,
I just have one quick thing. Before I came here, I graduated from culinary school, so I came in with a very critical eye of food at Cornell, and I've been on the adoption committee for the last 2 years and chaired this year. And I know that the great thing Dining has done is they've been very responsive to students' needs. If students come up and they say something, they'll try to institute it and they'll try to do things. The one thing I think that Dining is really lacking is marketing, promotion, advertising, and informing the consumers. Michelle Wilbur, who's a nutritionist, is great, and she's willing to work with students on an individual level, but nobody knows about her. Some of the dietary restrictions, people don't know how to get that information, don't know how to get at those resources. They're all there. And I think Dining has tried to make strides in reviewing their fresh take line and making it more, you know, nutritious in the retail component has been great, and I know they're trying to do some other things. But I do think they kind of shifted their focus, and I know a real big goal of the committee that I chair this year is focused on nutrition and focused on kind of being socially responsible and not putting food out there that has a negative effect.
Okay, just in the interest of time, there's two questions I wanted before we close the program. How many live in Weston, or have lived in Weston? Your thoughts, how do you look at those news?
Any other thoughts about the
Muslims?
I'll second that. If you have a prelim, you can just give up on the half meal because it takes so long to get your food.
Okay. Secondly, how many of you use any of the dining halls during the day, specifically at lunch in West?
I've done that a few times before. I did it last year, especially when I live on West. And it was kind of nice because it's like very, there aren't many people there, and like the food's very good and all of that. But yeah, I noticed it was pretty dead though. I don't really know why that is. I'm assuming it's because of the class schedule. It's downhill. So when people have all their books and stuff, especially if it's the weather's bad, they don't really want to truck down there and truck back to eat. So yeah, but I think the last year was really good.
How many of you wander to the other, houses, the dining halls that are not necessarily in your house? Is that on the list of houses?
Yeah.
So if at lunch the dining hall in your house was not open, would that be a problem for you? People are pretty accustomed to going from house to house.
Okay.
I want to talk about retail operations because I'm being respectful for your time. On campus, I want to know, do you know where they are? Are you getting enough variety? Are the hours of operation appropriate? Do they want to be able to send their and plot? Yes.
I live on North End in Walsh, and Carolina Town is right in Walsh, which is awesome. But I am an early riser on weekends, and I used to have gym class at 10 on Sundays, but I would try and go down there, but it was locked and nothing was open. And that was just really frustrating to me because the facilities are so big, and I mean, I was talking enough at the gym itself, but it doesn't open until 3 on Sundays, which is really tough for me, especially if I'm studying in my room. I want to go back and grab something. Remember, I can't have to go back upstairs. It's just that the hours there on the weekends are really inconvenient.
Okay.
Are you speaking
specifically in terms of, like, early shopping? Well, I want to talk about the retail operation in Central and Clark, and then any of the C stores that are on campus, convenience stores as well. But strictly those on campus, I'm focusing on that. And particularly those in the Central Campus and Asian Park.
The only dining I do on campus now is at retail. Living off campus, I only go to retail centers for the.
So what do you typically frequent? Which one?
I go to Live Cafe to get all my copies, trillion, that was my number one stop. And the new synopsis is probably my favorite for them.
Okay, new synopsis is like all your friends because we need
synapses. It's all there. I love it
every day.
Where is it?
It's in Wild Hall. It's not a lot of Twitter rumors.
Like Mike, I get all my coffee from Live, and then I pretty much only eat at Ivory Room. Because, the meal plan, I got a meal plan because I'm on campus in the evening for meetings like this a lot of nights, so I generally will grab food on campus and then go back to the library. Rather than walking, I live down in West, so rather than walking to West for dinner and walking back, so the meal plan that I got was 500 cigarette bucks, like that. So I'll usually go to Ivory Room because it's convenient for the libraries.
Okay. I typically, and I so personally, I mean, I have a meal plan on guarantee two meals a day, but just judging from what I've done this year, I mean, I haven't really been in the full meal hall for like a week. I have no meals, but most part of what I'm saying is that all my spending trips will be to Big Red Box, one of the retail organizations. And I think getting back to what I really issue, something that I hope to consider, is maybe know, and I'm giving $1,000 for a meal plan. Now, being that I'm losing, I think what it is to go to the dining hall, $12 for a meal, you're paying cash. And is there any possibility where, instead of not necessarily the Big Red Box family, you have a meal plan, you obviously gave us money, it's $12 to use the Big Red Box.
You've got on campus now for a couple of days, and you've got five different coffee brands on campus. You've got Kidney, you've got Instant Coffee, Seattle Press, Starbucks, you've got Fair Trade. Any preferences there?
Jimmy,
Seattle Press is rated
for that.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.